It's time now for Sunday Fireside as we feature talks of general authorities of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. On today's program, we feature two outstanding talks. Our first speaker, the late Elder L. Tom Perry, former member of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles of the Church, a BYU devotional address entitled Truth and Liberty, delivered September 17th in the year 1987. Our first speaker, Elder Perry.
At 2 p.m. on this very day, throughout all of the United States, bells of all shapes, sizes, and sounds will ring. 200 years ago today at approximately 2 o'clock, our time, delegates to the Grand Convention in Philadelphia started queuing up to sign their proposed Constitution of the United States. It would still require 9 months before it could really be called a Constitution. This happened on June 21st of 1788, when New Hampshire, the ninth state, ratified it. During that hot and humid summer of 1787, the delegates labored nearly 4 months in a stuffy building with windows closed most of the time to prevent their words from being heard by the outside world during their deliberations. You from the East Coast know what it is even with air conditioning. I can't imagine what it would be with windows closed in a small, stuffy room. Tempers would flare. Some delegates would go home early. Compromise and crisis would take place. Yet on September 17th, 1787, they signed a document that it is now the oldest written constitution of its kind in the world. It has served nearly 457 million Americans to date, 247 million of whom are alive today. Now, was it possible that these delegates, living in the 18th century rural society, could write a constitution that would effectively serve 247 million people living in the 20th century in this space age? What did they know that writers of hundreds of other constitutions since have not known? Was there something unique about its creation or the men who wrote it? Many of the delegates realized the importance of what they were doing. Benjamin Franklin had said that if the convention failed, mankind may hereafter, from this unfortunate incident, despair of establishing governments by human wisdom and leave it to chance, war, or conquest. Possibly this is the reason, in spite of ill health and personal suffering, that he attended the convention. Another delegate, Rufus King, said that his fears were more agitated for his country than he could express, that he conceived this to be the last opportunity of providing for a liberty and happiness for the people. Madison had also said at the beginning of the convention that the delegates were now digesting a plan which in its operation would decide forever the fate of Republican government. Hamilton had written in the Federalist Papers, "It has been frequently remarked that it seems to have been reserved for the people of this country, by their conduct and example, to decide the important question whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good government from the reflection and choice, or whether they would forever be destined to depend on their political constitutions, on accident and force." Certainly their recent experience with the British and with the Articles of Confederation would have led to this concern. But it still doesn't answer the question of how they were able to write our Constitution. I believe our prophet, Ezra Taft Benson, put his finger on the answer when he said in an address given here at Brigham Young University. It would be erroneous for us, however, to conclude that the document was the sole genius of the founding fathers. Theirs was a combined wisdom derived from heavenly inspiration, knowledge of political governments from past ages, and the crucible of their own experience. Inspiration, knowledge, and experience. For our purpose today, let us start by looking at some of the delegates, who they were, and what was their background and experience and knowledge. Thomas Jefferson had said of the convention after he heard who the delegates were, that it was an assembly of demigods. John Adams has also written, "The deliberate union was so great and various a people in such a place as this, without particular or prejudice, if not the greatest exertion of human understanding, the greatest single effort of a national deliberation that the world has ever seen." And Everett Wilson, writing in his book, The Constitution of the United States and the Bulwark of Liberty, states, "The American system was devised by the ablest group of men who ever appeared at the same time in the same country throughout all the history of the world. Just as the former times produced masterpieces in science and commercial organization, so the architects of the American plan of a self-disciplined liberty produced a masterpiece of free government." Now, who were these 55 men who in varying degrees were the framers of our national constitution? The knowledge concerning some of them is indefinite, but the following facts, I think, are substantially correct. All of them except eight were natives of the colonies. Franklin was the oldest at 81. Dayton, the youngest, was 26. 14 were over 50. 21 were less than 40. 25 were college men. These men were almost without exception acquainted with public affairs. 46 had been members of one or both of the houses of the colonial or state legislatures. 10 had attended state constitutional conventions. 16 had been governors or would be governors or presidents of states. In national affairs, 42 were delegates to the Continental Congress. 8 were signers of the Declaration of Independence. 6 were signers of the draft of the Articles of Confederation. 7 had attended the Annapolis Convention. And 3 had been executive officers under the Congress. Two future presidents of the United States took a prominent part in the proceedings of the convention, and one future vice president. Two others were to be candidates for the vice presidency. The position of which these men occupied, or were later to fill, marked the regard in which they were held by their fellow citizens, in their character, and in their worth. The most important man in the convention, of course, was George Washington. Indeed, his acceptance of the deputyship, made reluctantly after long consideration, was the initial triumph of the movement and a foreshadowing of success, so great was his prestige in the colonies. Madison and Randolph, his fellow deputies from Virginia, were very active in the work of the convention. Madison's great knowledge of political science, the fact that to him, more than any of the other deputies, public life was a profession, and his grasp of the essential problems before the convention and the means by which they could be solved, enabled him to become the principal architect of the Constitution. Franklin was the seer of the convention. His great age and the infirmities he was suffering made it difficult for him to have active participation, and he was probably responsible for little of the detailed results. But his very presence gave the important to the gathering gave importance and dignity, and his advice must have been eagerly and actively sought after and carefully considered. He and Washington were the two great harmonizers. Washington presided over the formal sessions, taking little part in the debate, but in the committee of the whole and in the private conferences, which was the important underpinning of the formal structure as it arose, he was in constant consultation with his colleagues. Also, as the character of the plan developed, there was general recognition of the fact that he must be the leading man in the early operation of the new government, and this of necessity influenced its shape. Years after the convention, James Madison had written of them, "I feel it a duty to express my profound and solemn conviction, derived from my intimate opportunity of observing and appreciating the views of the convention, collectively and individually, that there was never an assembly of men charged with so great and arduous trust, who were more pure in their motives, or more exclusively or anxiously devoted to the object committed to them, than were the members of the Federal Convention of 1787. They were extremely knowledgeable of government and had gained considerable experience as a result of serving in their various states. Some 23 of the signers had served in the war for independence and were intimately familiar with the deprivation and suffering caused by the lack of a strong union and a weak central government. George Washington had served 8 years as the commander and understood better than most this need. Even those who hadn't felt the direct effects of a weak and inefficient government at Valley Forge, Morristown, New York, or other battle sites, had witnessed the deteriorating state of their republic after the war. Commerce problems, rebellion, inflation caused by the printing of money. This was enough to convince even the most ardent supporters of the Articles of Confederation that something had to be done to render the Articles effective to the needs of the people in this day. Their individual and collective experience gained from the war and their involvement in state and national governments would help. Some had helped write their state constitutions, but they needed even more, an understanding of what had been tried in the past and what other ideas and opinions and options were available to them in that day. Most of the delegates were ardent students of government and had read exclusively on the subject. In fact, during the previous 2 decades, America had been awash with political tracts and writings on government and liberty. It is of deep interest to me to find the major source of the ideas for the Constitution. 2 professors made a diligent study, Donald S. Lutz and Charles S. Heineman. They reviewed some estimated 15,000 items and closely read 2,200 books, pamphlets, newspaper articles, and monographs with explicitly political content printed between 1760 and 1805. From these items, they identified 3,154 references to other sources in our Constitution. The source most often cited by the Founding Fathers was the Bible, which accounted for 34% of all citations. Heavy emphasis on biblical law was referred to frequently. The most cited thinkers were not deists and philosophers, but legal and political thinkers who were also Christian. They have so far Now we have so far reviewed two elements mentioned by President Benson, experience and knowledge. What about heavenly inspiration? Did any of the delegates attribute the writing of the Constitution to inspiration? The challenge before the delegates at the Constitutional Convention of 1787 was how to protect the individual's basic rights and at the same time provide for a union. Before the convention started, even George Washington, who was elected president of the convention, had his doubts. He said, "It is probable that no plan we propose will be adopted. Perhaps another dreadful conflict will be sustained. If to please the people, we offer what we ourselves disapprove, how can we afterwards defend our work? Let us raise a standard to which the wise and honest can repair. The event is in the hands of God." A year later, the day after Massachusetts ratified the Constitution, Washington would write to another friend, Lafayette, of the miraculous nature of their efforts. He wrote, "It appears to me a little short of a miracle that the delegates from so many different states, in their manners, circumstances, and prejudices, should unite in forming a system of national government." As President George Washington also said, "The hand of Providence has been so conspicuous in all of this that he must be worse than an infidel that lacks faith, and more than wicked that has not gratitude enough to acknowledge his obligations." Many of the other delegates also recognized divine inspiration in their work. Writing in the Federalist Papers, James Madison, often referred to as the father of the Constitution, wrote, "It would be impossible for a man of pious reflection not to perceive in it the finger of that almighty hand which has so frequently and signally extended our relief in the critical states of the Revolution." Alexander Hamilton, famous for the originator of the Federalist Papers, an author of 51 of those, said, "For my own part, I sincerely esteem it a system which without the finger of God never could have been suggested or agreed upon by such a diversity of interests." Benjamin Franklin, on April 8th of 1788, said, "I have so much faith in the general government of the world by Providence that I can hardly conceive a transaction of such momentous importance to the welfare of millions now existing and to exist in the posterity of a great nation should be suffered to pass without being in some degree influenced, guided, and governed by that omnipotent, omnipresent, and beneficent ruler in whom all inferior spirits live and move and have their being." Such comments have not been limited to delegates themselves, but others have studied the events concerned as well. Daniel Webster, a noted defender of the Constitution, although not a delegate, said in 1837, "I regard it, the Constitution, as the work of the purest patriots and the wisest statesmen that ever existed, aired by the smile of a benign providence. It almost appears a divine interposition in our behalf. The hand that destroys our Constitution renders our Union asunder forever." And even if we look today to great students of the Constitution, one being my fellow apostle, Elder Dallin H. Oaks. He recently spoke here in Provo while most of you students were away during the summer. He cited five inspired fundamentals of that document. First, the separation of powers in the three branches of government, the division of powers between the states and federal government. Third, the Bill of Rights. Fourth, the principle of popular sovereignty. And fifth and finally, there is divine inspiration in the fundamental underlying premise of our whole constitutional order. So it is the rule of law and not of men that governs it. All of the blessings we enjoy under the United States Constitution are dependent upon the rule of law. That is why President J. Reuben Clark said, "Our allegiance runs to the Constitution and its principles, which is it embodies, and not to individuals. The rule of law is the basis of liberty." Concerning the fourth of these great, truly divine principles, inspired by the fundamentals, is that of the sovereignty of the people. Elder Oaks also said, "Perhaps the most important and greatest fundamental of our inspired Constitution is the principle of popular sovereignty. The people are the source of government power. Along with many religious people, Latter-day Saints affirm that God gave the power to the people, and the people consented to a constitution that delegated certain powers to the government. Sovereignty is not inherent in a state or nation just because it has power that comes from armed forces. Sovereignty does not come from the divine right of a king who grants his subjects such power as he pleases or is forced to concede, such as in the Magna Carta. The sovereign power is in the people. I believe this is one of the great meanings in the Revelation, which tells us that God established the Constitution of the United States, that every man may act according to the moral agency which I have given unto him, that every man may be accountable for his own sins in the day of judgment. Therefore, it is not right that any man should be under bondage one to another. And for this purpose have I established the Constitution of this land." In other words, the most desirable condition for the effective exercise of God-given moral agency is a condition of maximum freedom and responsibility. In this condition, men are accountable for their own sins and cannot blame their political condition or their bondage on a king or a tyrant. This condition is achieved when the people are sovereign, as they are under the Constitution, God established for our nation. For this follows that the most important words in the United States Constitution are the words in the preamble: "We, the people of the United States, do ordain and establish this Constitution." President Benson expressed the fundamental principle of popular sovereignty when he said, "We, the people, are superior to government and should remain masters over it, not the other way around." The Book of Mormon explains this principle in these words: "An unrighteous king doth pervert the ways of all righteousness. Therefore choose you by the voice of the people judges, that ye may be judged according to the laws." Now it is not common that the voice of the people desireth anything contrary to that which is right, but it is common for the lesser part of the people to desire that which is not right. Therefore, this yet shall ye observe, and make it your law, to do your business by the voice of the people. Popular sovereignty necessarily implies popular responsibility. Instead of blaming troubles on kings and other sovereigns, all citizens must share the burden and responsibility of governing. As the Book of Mormon teaches us, burdens should come upon all people, that every man might bear his part. As a nation, we have been showered with numerous blessings that have been a direct result of our Constitution. Unfortunately, many of us have forgotten that with the receipt of such blessings also comes that responsibility. Probably the most important responsibility is that we ensure the continuance of freedoms that we have received for our children and for our grandchildren. We cannot do that from the sidelines. Patriotism is not a spectator sport. We must become involved in the process of freedom. Wherefore, honest and wise men should be sought for diligently, and good men and wise men ye should observe to uphold. Further, we need to understand the great principles of the founding documents. How can we befriend that law, which is constitutional law of the land, if we are not familiar with it and its genesis? We need to drink deeply at the wellspring of this great document. We must also recognize that, as President John Adams said, we have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions, unbridled by morality and religion. We are facing this situation to a degree in the world today. Therefore, we have the responsibility to remain unspotted from the world, to be upright and honest in all of our dealings, and to set the example for that which we have been given. Francis Grund wrote, "The American Constitution is remarkable for its simplicity, but it can only suffice a people habitually correct in their actions and would be utterly inadequate to the wants of a different nation. Change in the domestic habits of Americans, their religious devotion, and their high respect for morality, and it will not be necessary to change a single word in the Constitution in order to vary the whole form of their government." As Latter-day Saints, we should take heart what the late President David O. McKay counseled. Next to being one in worshiping God, there is nothing in this world upon which the Church should be more united than in upholding the Constitution of the United States. We as a people have been the recipients of some of God's most choice blessings, and I believe they came only as a result of the dedication and sacrifice of our forefathers. We need at this time and in this place to follow the counsel of yet another great American, Abraham Lincoln, when he said, "Let every American, every lover of liberty, every well-wisher to his posterity support the Constitution. Let it be taught in the schools, in seminaries and colleges. Let it be written in the primers, in the spelling books, and in the almanacs. Let it be preached from the pulpits, proclaimed in legislative halls, and enforced in courts of justice. In short, let it become the political religion of the nation, and in particular, establish a reverence for the Constitution." Now, I love this great land of the free. It has always been with a feeling of pride within my very soul when the flag passes by. I was taught this as a young child when Dad would always make us get out of the car when the American flag would pass by in a parade. This feeling has only increased over the years, as I have stood as a young Boy Scout early in the morning at flag-raising ceremonies, and throughout the years attending school and pledging allegiance to her before starting each day's schoolwork. Yes, and there have even been times on foreign soil, after the battle is over, when in dirty dungarees with a rifle in hand, I have stood and saluted our flag as it was raised to the top of a handmade flagpole. Oh, this be it ever, when free men shall stand between their loved homes and war's desolation, blessed with victory and peace, may the heaven's rescued land praise the power that hath made and preserved us a nation. Then conquer we must, when our cause it is just. And this be our motto, in God is our trust. And the star-spangled banner in triumph shall wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. May God bless each of us with the desire to gain a real understanding of the blessings granted to us under this great Constitution of the United States of America, and have the strength and the courage to defend and uphold it for our generation and all who will follow after us, is my humble prayer. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
You're listening to Sunday Fireside. You've just heard a talk by the late Elder L. Tom Perry, former member of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. A BYU devotional address from September 17th in the year 1987, entitled Truth and Liberty. Our concluding speaker today is Elder M. Russell Ballard of the Quorum of 12 Apostles of the Church. This is a special BYU Freedom Festival talk delivered during the 1992 Freedom Festival in Provo, Utah. Elder Ballard.
The breeze of freedom is blowing today with greater velocity throughout the world than perhaps any other time in history. However, a gathering like this would still not be legally permissible in many places. We are meeting here on the Brigham Young University campus, where the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints freely supports this great institution. Recently, a group of religious and political leaders and scholars from all around the world met in Budapest, Hungary, to discuss the practical challenges faced by the former communist nations that are moving toward some form of religious liberty. The concept of religious freedom is revolutionary for many countries, and they are struggling with many potentially divisive issues. To what extent should public schools recognize and teach religion? How much should the state regulate the church's charitable activities? Should churches be exempted from general laws? To what degree should church and state be separated? Should there be an official state church? Do those issues sound familiar? They should. Our founding fathers wrestled with them more than 200 years ago, and they continue to be serious topics of discussion and debate to this very day. The latitude we have for disagreement and discourse more than 200 years after the United States Constitution and its Bill of Rights were enacted is a remarkable testimony to the enduring nature of those precious documents. The principles and philosophies upon which our constitutional law is based are not simply the results of the best efforts of a remarkable group of brilliant men. They were inspired by God, and the rights and privileges guaranteed in the Constitution are God-given, not man-derived. The freedom and independence afforded by the Constitution and Bill of Rights are divine rights, sacred, essential, and inalienable. In the 98th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, the Lord indicates that the law of the land, which is constitutional, supporting that principle of freedom in maintaining rights and privileges, belongs to all mankind and is justifiable before me. I focus my comments this evening on 16 significant words found in the very First Amendment to the Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. These words are simple and direct. Their message and meaning appear to be crystal clear. But through the years, presidents, Congress, and the courts have interpreted them in so many different ways that many people today have no sense of the perspective upon which they were based originally. Believe it or not, at one time the very notion of government had less to do with politics than with virtue. According to James Madison, often referred to as the father of the Constitution, we have staked the whole future of American civilization upon the power of the government. Far from it, we have staked the future of all of our political institutions upon the capacity of each and all of us to govern ourselves according to the Ten Commandments of God. Close quote. George Washington agreed with his colleague James Madison. Said Washington, "Reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle." Close quote. Nearly 100 years later, Abraham Lincoln responded to a question about which side God was on during the Civil War with this profound thought, "I'm not at all concerned about that, for I know that the Lord is always on the side of right. But it is my constant anxiety and prayer that I and this nation should be on the Lord's side." Close quote. Madison, Washington, and Lincoln all understood that democracy cannot possibly flourish in a moral vacuum, and that organized religion plays an important role in preserving and maintaining public morality. Indeed, John Adams, another of America's founding fathers, insisted, "We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion." Close quote. Yet that is precisely the position we find ourselves in today. Our government is succumbing to the pressure to distance itself from God and religion. Consequently, the government is discovering that it is incapable of contending with people who are increasingly unbridled by morality and religion. A simple constitutional prohibition of a state-sponsored church has evolved into court-ordered bans against, 1, representations of the Ten Commandments on government buildings, 2, Christmas manger scenes on public property, and now recently, 3, public prayer in public meetings. Instead of seeking the national morality based on religious principle that Washington spoke of, many are actively seeking a blind standard of legislative amorality with a total exclusion of the mention of God in the public square. Such a standard of religious exclusion is absolutely and unequivocally counter to the intention of those who designed our government. Do you think that a mere chance placed the freedom to worship according to individual conscience among the first freedoms specified in the Bill of Rights, freedoms that are destined to flourish together or perish separately? The founding fathers understood this country's spiritual heritage. They frequently declared that God's hand was upon this nation and that He was working through them to create what Chesterton once wrote, a nation with the soul of a church. While they were influenced by history and their accumulated knowledge and learning, the simple, most influential reference source for their work on the Constitution was the Holy Bible, Doubtless they were familiar with the Lord's counsel to the children of Israel as they struggled to become a great nation. Quote, "And it shall come to pass, if thou shalt hearken diligently unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe and do all his commandments which I command thee this day, that the Lord thy God will set thee on high above all nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come on thee and overtake thee, if thou shalt hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God. Blessed shall thou be in the city, and blessed shalt thou be in the field. Blessed shall be the fruit of thy body, and the fruit of thy ground, and the fruit of thy cattle, the increase of thine kind, and the flocks of thy sheep. Blessed shall be thy basket and thy store. Blessed shall be thou be when thou comest in, and blessed thou shalt be when thou goest out. The Lord shall cause thine enemies to rise up against thee to be smitten before thy face. They shall come out against thee one way, and flee before thee seven ways. The Lord shall command the blessings upon thee in thy storehouses, and in all that thou settest thine hand unto. And he shall bless thee in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. The Lord shall establish thee an holy people unto himself, as he hath sworn unto thee, if thou shalt keep the commandments of the Lord thy God and walk in his ways." Close quote. In other words, that nation that keeps God's commandments and walks in his ways will prosper. The framers of the Constitution knew that, and they tried to lay a solid moral foundation for a society that could be so blessed. As they did so, perhaps they thought of Roger Williams and others like him who made an heroic fight for religious freedom. Roger Williams, as you know, was one of the most courageous leaders of the Puritan movement. He began his ministry in England, where his zealous work to free the church from the influence of the king brought the wrath of the government upon him. Eventually, he and his young wife were forced to flee to the New World. But instead of finding himself among like-minded reformers in America, he encountered much of the same resistance and persecution until he established a new colony called Providence in Rhode Island. Here America had its first taste of true religious freedom. And the success of the Providence colony convinced many that the concept tasted good. The founding fathers very likely were aware of the experiences of Roger Williams and others when they wrote the First Amendment, that the government cannot impede the free exercise of religion. They wrote that the church and the state were to be separate, independent entities, not to eliminate morality in God's laws, but to make sure that the power of government could never be used to silence religious expression or to persecute religious practice. Once again, quoting George Washington, "If I could have entertained the slightest apprehension that the Constitution framed in the convention, where I had the honor to preside, might possibly endanger the religious rights of any ecclesiastical society, certainly I would never have placed my signature to it." What would Washington have thought if he could have foreseen our day? Would he have signed the document? I believe he would have been troubled to see a time when citizens are forbidden to pray in public meetings, when people claim that you can't legislate morality, as if any law ever passed did not have at its heart some notion of right and wrong. When churches are called intruders, when they speak out against public policy that is contrary to the commandments of God, when many people reject the correcting influence of churches if it infringes on daily living, when religion is accepted as a social organization but not as an integral part of the national culture, when people bristle if churches speak in any form except from the pulpit. Indeed, some people now claim that the Founding Fathers' worst fear in connection with religion has been realized, that we have, in fact, a state-sponsored religion in America today. This new religion, adopted by many, does not have an identifiable name, but it operates just like a church. It exists in the form of doctrines and beliefs where morality is whatever a person wants it to be, and where freedom is derived from the ideas of man and not the laws of God. Many people adhere to this concept of morality with religious zeal and fervor, and courts and legislators tend to support it. While you may think I'm stretching the point a bit to say that amorality could be a new state-sponsored religion, I believe you would agree that we do not have to look far to find horrifying evidence of rampant immorality that is permitted, if not encouraged, by our laws. From the plague of pornography to the devastation caused by addiction to drugs, illicit sex, and gambling, wickedness rears its ugly head everywhere, often gaining its foothold in society by invoking the powers of constitutional privilege. We see a sad reality of contemporary life when many of the same people who defend the right of a pornographer to distribute exploitative films and photos would deny freedom of expression to people of faith because of an alleged fear of what might happen from religious influence on government or public meetings. While much of the society has allowed gambling to wash over its communities, leaving broken families and individuals in its soul-destroying wake, it reserves its harshest ridicule for those who advocate obedience to God's commandments and uniform inspired standards of right and wrong. As M.J. Sobran recently wrote, "A religious conviction is now a second-class conviction, expecting to step deferentially to the back of the secular bus and not to get uppity about it." Close quote. There are probably many reasons for the change in public attitudes towards religion. Certainly, we've had too many wolves posing as shepherds, promoting a natural skepticism toward any who profess to represent God on earth. Of course, the news media, which rarely report on the good things churches are doing in the world, almost never miss an opportunity to tell people when active church members do wrong. We read about crimes that are committed by the former Sunday school teachers, ministers, or missionaries. But when was the last time you read that a crime was committed by someone who hasn't stepped inside of a church in 40 years? For that matter, when was the last time you saw religion or people of faith portrayed positively in any film or television program? For the most part, Hollywood's attitude towards religion is typified by the expression of the cartoon character Bart Simpson, whose mealtime grace consisted of these words: "Dear God, we pay for all of this stuff ourselves, so thanks for nothing." Can you imagine how embarrassed and disappointed our founding fathers would be to know of the blasphemous disregard that many of those in the media have for God, our eternal Father? In fact, noted film critic Michael Medved accuses Hollywood of a deliberate attempt to undermine organized religion. According to Medved, quote, "A war against standards leads logically and inevitably to hostility to religion, because it is religious faith that provides the ultimate basis for our standards. Organized religion finds itself increasingly on the defensive." Close quote. Not only are people questioning the right of the church, any church, to be involved in matters of public policy, but some are even beginning to wonder whether the church is entitled to exert any kind of meaningful influence in people's lives. As one churchgoer recently said on a radio talk show, quote, "I think the world of my minister, as long as he doesn't try to tell me how to live my life." Close quote. Is it any wonder, then, that religion now finds itself under attack in legislative assemblies and in the courts? In fact, the United States Supreme Court recently discontinued the time-honored judicial standard that gave considerable legal latitude to the free exercise of religion, allowing people of faith to practice their religion free from the burdening effects of public policy is, according to the court, a luxury that we can no longer afford. While the justices acknowledged that the ruling would place at a relatively disadvantage those religious practices that are not widely engaged in, they said it was an unavoidable consequence of a democratic government. I do not promote the religious practice that was in question in that case, but I'm concerned with the long-term implications of the decision. Wherever religious groups are in the minority and are not considered part of the mainline religious community, the potential for state intrusion upon their religious practices is real. With legislative bodies responding most often to the will of the majority, the free exercise of religion by minority faith groups is in peril. The Religious Freedoms Restoration Act, H.R. 2797, is presently before Congress. This important piece of legislation is designed to restore the protection for religious freedom that existed before the recent Supreme Court decision placed those protections in jeopardy. Because the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is necessary for the preservation of the free exercise of religion, it demands our support. The constitutional provisions relating to government and religion were not intended to control the religious rights of people. Rather, they were intended to expand them and eliminate the fear of government intrusion. These provisions were meant to separate religion and government so that religion would be independent. The experiences of Roger Williams and other reformers provided our constitutional fathers with important facts to help them deal with the potential risk of a state religion corrupted by politics. Consequently, they drafted an article in the Bill of Rights to guarantee religious freedom from government as opposed to the government freedom from religion. In fact, the framers of the Constitution probably assumed that religious freedom would establish religion as a watchdog over government, and believed that free churches would inevitably stand and speak against immoral or corrupt legislation. To do so, all churches not only have the right to speak out on public moral issues, but they have the solemn obligation to do so. Religion represents society's conscience and must speak out when government chooses a course that is contrary to the laws of God. To remember the influence of religion from public policy, to remove that from public policy simply because some are uncomfortable with any degree of moral restraint is like a passenger on a sinking ship who removes his life jacket because it's restrictive and uncomfortable. We live in a day of political and social unrest. People are beginning to understand that more money and new government programs do not solve the problems of a disintegrating morality in the homes and communities. People in the land have a feeling that things are not right. Voters everywhere are looking for a great leader to come along and straighten everything out. The buzzwords family values are being incorporated in almost every politician's favorite 30-second soundbite. But what does that phrase really mean? Whose values are we going to embrace? the values of politicians, the values the media tell us we should cherish, the values of special interest groups and organizations, the values of rank and file Americans as determined by a scientific survey, obviously it would not be politically expedient to say that the values that our founding fathers drew upon are eternal, unchanging values. But that is a fact. The values that made us great in reality are the commandments of God. They provide the foundation upon which our republic was built. And if American democracy seems shaky today, it's only because that foundation has been eroded and weakened under the guise of separation of church and state. Now that I think about it, maybe Washington really was speaking of our day when he said, "If I could conceive that the general government might ever be so administered as to render the liberty of conscience insecure, no one would be more zealous than myself to establish effectual barriers against the horrors of spiritual tyranny and every species of religious persecution." Close quote. Samuel Adams, who is sometimes called the father of the American Revolution, wrote, "I thank God that I have lived to see my country independent and free. She may long enjoy her independence and freedom as she will. It depends upon her virtue." That means it depends on us. If we would maintain the independence and freedom the founding fathers intended, we must work to preserve and protect the moral foundation upon which they build our government. We must stand boldly for righteousness and truth, and must defend the cause of honor, decency, and personal freedom espoused by Washington, Madison, Adams, Lincoln, and other leaders who acknowledged and loved God. Otherwise, we will find ourselves in the same predicament, President Lincoln observed in 1863. Said Lincoln, "We have grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no nation has ever grown, but we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand which preserved us in peace and multiplied and enriched and strengthened us. We have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our hearts that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace, too proud to pray to the God that made us." Close quote. On this occasion, let us resolve to make our own families truly free by teaching them that God holds us all accountable. His laws are absolutes. Breaking them brings misery and unhappiness. Keeping them brings joy, happiness, and the blessings of heaven. Let us teach our families and others the importance of moral responsibility based on the laws of God. Let us all resolve to listen to moral voices from churches and to those who speak in moral absolutes based on the commandments of God. Let us never support legislation or legislators that sponsor laws contrary to the laws of God. Freedoms we give thanks for tonight is at stake for ourselves and for our posterity. No nation or people that rejects God or His commandments can prosper or find happiness. History and the Scriptures are filled with examples of nations that rejected God. Let us be wise and remember the source of our blessings and not be timid or apologetic in sharing this knowledge with others. There is no better place in this precious land of America than the great state of Utah for a people to embrace and declare that our trust is in God and that we will look to His commandments and teachings for values that will fortify and give direction to to society and to our families. Only these values can ensure true happiness, lasting peace and joy. May the leaders of the churches of America and the churches of Utah be allowed to help our nation and state to embrace these basic principles espoused and fought for by the founding fathers of this great nation. This is my prayer for all of us, but most especially for the future of my children and grandchildren and for yours. And I offer it humbly but boldly in the name of God's own Son, even Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
You've been listening to Sunday Fireside. You've just heard a talk by Elder M. Russell Ballard of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a BYU Freedom Festival talk delivered in 1992 during the Freedom Festival. We invite you to join us again next week for another program in this series on the Sounds of Sunday and Sunday Fireside.